The United California Bank in Laguna Niguel, California, was part of a very affluent neighborhood. The bank sat adjacent to a retirement community for the rich and famous in an area known for lavish homes, upscale hotels, beautiful beaches, and exclusive golf courses. During his presidency, Richard Nixon was rumored to be one of the bank's high-powered patrons along with other local elites. The bank was recognized as a secure place to keep cash, especially among people who didn't want the IRS or anyone else to know about it. But on March 24th of 1972, when employees tried to open the bank's vault, they realized something was wrong. The vault's state-of-the-art door wouldn't open. The mechanism seemed to be jammed from the inside. They called in technical support, and when the vault was finally opened, workers found a complete mess. There was a large hole in the ceiling, and a thick layer of gray dust covered everything inside. The dust was from the hole blown in the vault's 18-inch thick reinforced concrete ceiling. But curiously, there was also soil on the vault floor. Passing down through the ceiling was an extension cord and one of those hanging work lamps you might use in your garage. About 500 of the vault's double-key, armor-plated safe deposit boxes were scattered around the room empty. The thieves hadn't gotten into all of the boxes, though. Police found burglary tools in the vault, too, including a customized sledgehammer specially designed with a homemade key-type device on its end to help open the deposit boxes. Investigators even found milk cartons filled with water, which they figured were used to cool down power drills. A single cotton work glove was also found in the vault. An estimated $8 to $12 million in cash, stocks, bonds, and jewelry had been taken. At that time, the largest theft from a bank in U.S. history, it would equal about $100 million today. Local law enforcement immediately brought in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and 8 agents were assigned to the case. But over the next few weeks, when the FBI came up with almost no physical evidence, including no fingerprints, the number of agents rose to 125. One of the advantages the FBI has is its extensive network of agencies throughout the U.S. So the Bureau notified its other offices to see if the MO, modus operandi, or in English, the method of operations, well, if that might match any of the other crimes. Agents from Cleveland, Ohio, reported a string of bank burglaries around their jurisdiction that showed similarities to the California heist, including one in their area not long after the Laguna Niguel job. Even more importantly, Cleveland had a suspect. The man was 36-year-old Emil Alfred Dinzio from Youngstown in my home state of Ohio. Now, you might never have heard of Youngstown, but it sits about midway between Cleveland, Ohio and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, home of the United Steelworkers. Although once prosperous because of its steel mills, Youngstown, like so many larger cities around it, eventually suffered the so-called Rust Belt Depression that hit during the second half of the 20th century. In both its heyday and its hard times, this area was heavily associated with organized crime. Syndicates from both Cleveland and Pittsburgh battled over Youngstown as part of their turf, leading to a string of car bombings attributed to the mob in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Things were so bad that in 1963, the Saturday Evening Post dubbed Youngstown Crimetown, USA. Though Dinzio wasn't known for violence, he had been part of organized crime since his teenage years. Dinzio was linked to a series of smaller bank burglaries in Northeast Ohio and in the Eastern U.S., and stretching as far south as Florida. In some cases, Dinzio was just considered a person of interest by police, but he did have convictions, just nothing serious enough to put him in prison for any significant amount of time. Dinzio was no dummy. He was good with his hands and had a fair amount of engineering and mechanical know-how. But in order to consider him a serious suspect for the United California job, the FBI would have to start by figuring out if Dinzio was in California at the time. One way law enforcement typically tracks people is using the trails left by financial transactions, especially purchases. But back in 1972, that type of investigation was much more labor-intensive than it is today. I mean, the internet wasn't around, and far more people used cash back then than today's easily tracked debit and credit card transactions. There were still plenty of traceable purchases in those days, though, especially to try and figure out if someone had traveled between Ohio and California. As you might have guessed, investigators headed straight to the California airport closest to the bank, Los Angeles International. There, the ticket archives show Denzio and his six-man crew had come through the airport a week before the heist. FBI agents questioned airport taxi drivers using photographs of Denzio and his men to see if anyone looked familiar. One of the cabbies remembered Denzio for the $100 tip the man had given him. Records showed that the taxi had driven the men to the home of Denzio's sister, who just happened to live in Orange County, the same county as the bank. Police figured the five men wouldn't all have stayed at his sister's modest home, so they took the photographs of Denzio and the other suspects to nearby hotels, where one of the desk clerks recognized some of the men. Now next, investigators examined phone records from the hotel on the night the crew came in, and they found one of the numbers called belonged to a real estate agency. Then they learned that Denzio's two nephews, who were part of his gang, had leased a furnished golf resort condo that sat in the direct line of sight of the United California Bank. As soon as FBI agents walked into the condo, though, they had a sinking feeling they were too late. The place had been completely and professionally cleaned. The carpet, walls, everything. Even the furniture had been wiped down with a thick layer of polish. The agents thought they had reached a dead end until one of them opened the condo's dishwasher and miraculously found a load of dirty dishes. Although months had passed, forensic analysts found the fingerprints of all seven members of Denzio's Youngstown gang on items in that dishwasher. Now, at the same time agents were investigating the condominium lead, others had been following up on another California phone number that was called from the gang's first night hotel. That number belonged to a man who had previously lived in Youngstown. And when agents went to his house, the guy said not only did he know some of the suspects, but they had left their car in his garage. FBI agents found an Oldsmobile Super 88 in the garage. It was purchased in California, and it was no doubt the getaway vehicle. How'd they know? Well, the seats were covered with a layer of concrete dust, there were burglary tools in the trunk, and they found the mate to the cotton glove that had been discovered in the bank vault. Ultimately, they found fingerprints from five of the suspects and lifted them from the car. Once they caught up with the mobsters, authorities learned much more detail about the burglary. Denzio had first made an initial reconnaissance trip to prepare for the job. He had cased the bank and surveyed the typical activities of the local police department, which was a surprisingly small agency. Once he had things all mapped out in his mind, Denzio returned to Youngstown to assemble his crew based on the expertise he felt the job needed. Now, when the gang arrived in California for the heist, after renting the condo and buying the car, Denzio's men attended other matters. They took their time assembling the tools they'd need. They sent different guys to different stores in order to not raise suspicion. Among the things they bought were a ladder, empty sandbags, a variety of hand tools, including an acetylene torch, as well as a police band radio. On the night of the burglary, one man stayed at the condo and monitored the radio, while another one walked to the bank to stand guard with his own radio. Then Denzio and four other men got in the car and drove over to the bank. Two of them got out and began filling the empty sandbags with soil from a nearby flower bed. The others put a ladder up to the bank's roof in the vicinity of the outside alarm. Now, while two of the men held Denzio's ankles, he sprayed the alarm with foam insulation so that when it went off, the clapper couldn't hit the bell. The bank's exterior flat roof was made of a half-inch plywood, and the burglars easily cut an opening in it large enough to pass through. Once they were inside the attic crawl space, they patched into the bank's air conditioning unit to get electric power. Then they drilled 15 holes in the 18-inch steel reinforced ceiling over the vault and put a stick of dynamite into each hole. The bags of soil were then piled on top of the dynamite to force the explosion to travel downward and also act like a silencer for the blast. Once inside, they could use the empty bags to carry their loot. After setting off the explosion, the men used the acetylene torches to cut the reinforcing rebar and then drop down into the vault. Next, they had to bypass another alarm in the vault that was wired to go straight to the sheriff's office. Now, one of the most amazing things to me was that this bank heist lasted 3 nights. D'Annunzio and his crew broke in on Friday night, took everything they could before dawn, and then lightly sealed their entry hole in the bank's roof. Then the men rigged a mirror on a stand and put it on top of the entry hatch, knowing as long as they could see the mirror from their condo window, the break-in hadn't been discovered. So then they came back Saturday night and Sunday night, draining the vault until literally just hours before the bank was set to open on Monday morning. After his arrest, investigators found some of the stolen property in D'Annunzio's house, including rare coins that their California owner could identify. D'Annunzio was convicted of burglary and sentenced to 10 years in prison. His crew was also prosecuted for their part in the theft. In late 2013, D'Annunzio published a book called Inside the Vault, The True Story of a Master Bank Burglar. Now, let's travel to Australia and look at another interesting heist. In the mid-1990s, the Bank of Melbourne in Victoria was a much simpler prime target for thieves. The building was situated with a back door that led to a walled-in courtyard adjacent to an alley. Now, by scaling the wall from the alley side, a person could easily get onto the roof of a small outbuilding that was just inside the bank's courtyard. And from there, it was an easy drop down into the bank's yard. Now, if a person listened carefully near the back door, they could hear the beeps that marked the opening of the vault from outside. The bank was also close to a train station, so bandits could easily disappear into the crowd and be far away in no time. The thieves even chose the perfect day to strike, September 14, 1996. That was the Saturday morning of the Australian football semifinals being played in Melbourne. They knew the bulk of the police force would be at the stadium for security, and that most people would either be at the game or watching it on TV, not out and about in town. The men planned to attack as the bank was opening for the day, between the time that workers arrived and when they opened the bank for business. This was because the thieves knew the vault had to be opened then in order to stock the teller's cash drawers for the day. The timing would also allow fewer witnesses, and there wouldn't be any customers who might panic and complicate things. Now, the night before the robbery, the men used a power saw to cut a large, square groove in the lower end of the bank's back door. They only went about halfway through the door's depth. They already knew the relative thickness of the door because they had cased the bank and they had watched employees go in and out of it. The crooks knew once they entered, the tellers would probably hit the bank's silent panic buttons. But the makeshift door within a door they had created would let them in and get out quickly, without actually opening the back door and tripping its alarm. And this would at least buy them a couple of seconds on the way in, which was really important if they were going to catch the vault while the door was still open. Now, on the morning of the robbery, the two men waited out back for the beeps that would signal the vault was opening to start the bank's day. And when they heard their cue, the men rammed that weakened back door with steel fence posts. They ducked through the opening they created and jumped in. While one robber used a gun to control the employees, the other emptied the vault and the teller's boxes. The whole heist took just a little over 2 minutes, and the pair left with $137,000 in cash, plus a stash of blank traveler's checks and bank drafts. That wasn't a huge haul, but these guys were well prepared and they were careful not to leave clues. During the initial investigation, police collected statements from the three tellers. All three described both men as being slim, about 5 feet 6 inches tall, and with native Australian accents. The most remarkable aspect was that the pair wore these black-colored Janus masks. Those are the traditional pair of theater faces depicting comedy and tragedy. One man wore the smiling mask and his partner wore the sad face. Both of those men wore them over black, open-faced ski masks. So together, the ski hood combined with the theater mask completely hid the perpetrator's skin, hair color, eye color, and any detail of their ears, mouths, or their teeth. Not only did their disguises hide the men from the witnesses, but also from the video surveillance cameras as well. As far as the rest of their clothing, the man with the gun wore a military green style coverall suit that had a small German flag sewn onto one arm. The other guy had a similar coverall that had an elastic waist and it had pockets, but not a German flag. One of the tellers said she saw an oblong shape in the back pocket of that man's outfit that looked like a cell phone, which in 1996 were not nearly as common and much larger than today's cell phones. The employee also noticed a light blinking on the object, which in those days usually meant a phone message had been left. The robbers wore black ski gloves with red stitching, and when one man had taken his off, the teller saw a surgical type glove underneath it. The gun involved was a small black handgun, and the guy handling the money had a backpack he stuffed with the cash. Now you might wonder how the employees gathered so much detail, especially when staring down the barrel of a gun. After all, one of the problems with eyewitness testimony is a phenomenon we call weapon focus. In other words, a witness to a crime that involves a gun or a knife is understandably preoccupied with the weapon. Well, bank employees, just like security guards and others who work in occupations that might be criminal targets, well, those types of people are specifically trained to study every detail of a robber's appearance, if they possibly can, for situations just like this. In fact, after herding the three bank employees under a table, one robber noticed one of the women studying him carefully, and he commanded her, "Do not look." Luckily, the robbers also told the workers they would not be hurt, and they weren't. Because the bad guys were last seen on foot, investigators brought in a police dog named Boss from the canine unit. A Boss was able to track the robber's scent to the nearby train station, where the handlers worried the trail would be lost on the platform. But to their surprise, the dog crossed the tracks instead, suggesting the criminals didn't get on the train. Once on the other side, though, Boss got all confused in the station's parking lot. Either the football game's extensive crowd that morning caused the dog to lose the scent, or more likely, the men had gotten into a getaway car that was parked in the lot. As the officers walked the dog around the parking area, they evaluated other possible options. Even in those days, investigators could check pings off cell phone towers. So they did consider that angle, since a getaway car might have called the robber's cell phone, or the bad guys could have also called the getaway driver for a pickup. Police could also investigate stores where high-tech power saws were sold, because they figured the tool had to be battery-operated, not electric, since there was no outlet in the bank courtyard. And a gas-powered saw would probably have made a lot of noise to attract attention. Detectives also knew they would probably catch anybody who tried to pass any of the bank or traveler's checks, since the numbers of those were already on record. But they decided instead to take the dog back to the bank for another try, even if just to find additional evidence. And good old Boss led them straight to a dumpster in the alley behind the bank. Inside was a pair of coveralls, a pair of outer gloves with surgical gloves layered inside them, a black ski mask, and the pair of theatrical masks. Good dog. In the yard adjacent to the bank, police located another pair of gloves, a second ski mask, and a baseball cap. They also found a couple of shoe impressions in the soil at the bottom of the wall, just behind the small shed in the bank's courtyard. Well, the direction and proximity of the footprints suggested they could have been left by someone trying to scale the wall and reach the bank. So even though investigators didn't have the bad guys, they had a lot of leads to explore. Some officers were sent to local theatrical stores to see if they could get anywhere with those Janus masks. They couldn't, even though they were pretty fancy masks with a fabric liner. The serial numbers on the military clothing indicated that the coveralls were the type that were routinely used in training. But investigators couldn't track them beyond that point, not even by checking local Army surplus stores. Police couldn't find a nearby source for any type of handheld battery-operated saw either. Even the cell phone tower analysis led nowhere. So the next step was to look up any questionable characters to see if some of the local bad guys had suddenly struck it rich. Nothing. None of the bank checks surfaced either. There had already been 28 bank robberies in Victoria between July of 1995 and February of 1996, and 11 of those were at the Bank of Melbourne branches. So they started making comparisons between this September heist and those other robberies to look for any possible patterns. But again, nothing. Ironically, things had gotten so bad for the Bank of Melbourne that the branch robbed in September was already set for relocation to a more secure facility. The scheduled date for that move turned out to be 2 weeks too late. Despite all the leads they had, the case looked like it might go cold. Now, this was back in 1996, and DNA technology was certainly being used at the time. But up to this point, a significant amount of biological material was typically needed, or at least used, to generate a DNA profile. A sufficient amount of cells for analysis could be found in something like a semen stain in a rape victim's panties, or maybe a drop of blood on a wounded killer, or drop of a wounded killer's blood on a homicide victim's shirt. But one of the things that DNA analysts were often finding around this time was when they got criminal DNA profiles from stains found on clothing, there was often a small amount of DNA from a second person. It turned out almost invariably that the other DNA profile came from the person who had been wearing the clothes rather than from the perpetrator. The source was a background level of skin cells from the wearer of the clothing, with which analysts had been previously overlooking. In fact, it was actually a pair of forensic scientists from the Victoria, Australia Police Lab, not too far from the bank we've been talking about, who, by the time of the robbery, had already submitted an article to the prestigious journal Nature about this phenomenon they were calling trace DNA. So the forensic lab decided to test the clothing left behind near the robbery scene for trace DNA. They got nothing out of the ski masks, no DNA from any of the gloves or the baseball cap. But what about the cloth lining of the two Janus theatrical masks? Behind the area of the mouth opening in each mask, there turned out to be enough saliva and shed skin cells to develop a genetic fingerprint. Just 6 days after the crime, the testing confirmed a different male profile from each mask. They were assumed to be from the robbers. Great news, right? But to nail a suspect, you need a known sample of his DNA for comparison, and the police didn't have that. They didn't even have any firm suspects. In addition, investigators didn't yet have the type of computerized DNA databases we have today, in which genetic profiles can be compiled and then compared at local, state, and even national levels. At that point, the best analysts could do was manually compare the recovered DNA profiles to any possibilities they found, such as maybe bad guys who had committed other bank robberies. The next big break came a few months later when some of the stolen bank checks started surfacing. Two guys claiming to be from a catering company went into a butcher shop and used one of the checks to buy, you ready for this, over $22,000 worth of filet mignon steak. Turns out they sold the steaks to another butcher to get cash. And a couple days later, the pair went into a wine store and tried to buy $86,000 of wine. That's when police arrested them. Turned out these weren't our bad guys. They had gotten the checks from somebody else who said he got them from another guy and so on. That trail led nowhere. Police had yet another lead when they learned from the wine shop owner that somebody had called that morning to make sure the big order was all set for pickup. One of the numbers pulled from the store's phone logs turned out to be from a woman known to hang with a guy who had 4 prior convictions for armed robbery. Pay dirt, right? Nope, the Melbourne bank heist couldn't be traced to him either. The case just went completely cold. Although the 2 DNA profiles were entered into Victoria's brand new DNA database in 1999, they just sat there waiting. Then, in 2000, in a rural area outside Melbourne, police tried to pull a driver over because the numbers on his license plate were only partly visible. But rather than slowing down, the guy sped off in what was to become a 1-hour high-speed police chase along a country road leading up to the city. Approaching Melbourne, the driver started weaving in and out of traffic and eventually wrecked his car. He then took off on foot, ran to another vehicle, and used a screwdriver to carjack its owner. From there, the maniac drove the stolen car to a shopping mall, where he got out and grabbed the keys from a woman who was trying to put her baby in her car. But as the bad guy ran around to the driver's side, security guards raced up and tackled him. Police arrested 35-year-old Goran Stamenkovic, who was soon tried and convicted on a long string of offenses, not just the violent assaults and the driving violations, but also for drug possession. He was sentenced to prison for a minimum of 4 years. Now, during Stamenkovic's incarceration, a law was passed requiring DNA to be taken from certain classes of convicts and then put into the Victoria forensic database. Stamenkovic's sample was submitted before his release, which had been scheduled for 2004. Wouldn't you know, 8 years after the Melbourne bank heist, Stamenkovic's genetic profile matched the trace DNA that had come from one of the theater masks. And just to be sure there had been no mistake, investigators went back and found the 1996 police file and the stored evidence. And by 2004, DNA technology was significantly improved over its capabilities at the time of the first testing. When forensic scientists reanalyzed the surgical gloves they had found that had been found at the bank heist, they were able to pull out 2 complete DNA profiles, as well as a partial third. One of the full profiles again proved to be a match to the DNA sample taken from Stamenkovic in prison. But that loser that fled police on that country road in 2000 sure didn't seem to match the sophisticated criminal style that was demonstrated back during the 1996 robbery. So as a final check, they even had Stamenkovic retested. It was him, all right. Either he hadn't been the mastermind or drugs had turned that man's brain to a desperate mush. Detectives tried to bargain with Stamenkovic to give up his partner in the bank heist, but he wouldn't cooperate. But in an amazing stroke of luck, just a couple of months later, a man was arrested for the armed robbery of a woman in her Melbourne apartment. Due to the nature of the offense and the perpetrator's extensive criminal history, they took a DNA sample from him almost immediately. As soon as the man's profile went into the Victoria database, it came up as a match to the surgical gloves worn by the second bandit in the Melbourne robbery. How 43-year-old Michael Mann was walking free to rob that woman, I will never know, since he already had a record that included 63 crimes dating all the way back to his teenage years. In fact, he had recently been rearrested and was out on bail when he robbed the woman's apartment. Finally, after 8 long years, investigators knew the identity of the 2 men who had broken through the back door of the Bank of Melbourne, frightened the staff, and stolen cash and checks. But the pair absolutely refused to talk, so investigators still have no idea about a possible getaway driver, or anything else related to the case. Based on the DNA recovered from the Janus theatrical masks, Mann had worn the frown of tragedy during the holdup, while Stamenkovic wore the comedy mask. But neither of them was smiling in 2007 when they were sentenced to 7 years each.